You've likely heard the stereotype that Black people don't swim. I discuss the origins of that myth with UC Merced history professor Kevin Dawson. He has traced the intersection of swimming, race, and power in America back to slavery.
I want to start out by talking about the first West Africans who were enslaved and brought to the colonies. What would their relationship have been with the open waters?
So Africans had a really rich aquatic tradition. They had developed the freestyle, also known as the crawl, centuries ago, well before the arrival of Europeans in 1444. They had also invented surfing, and they were skilled at underwater diving. And so slave traders actually targeted Africans with underwater diving and swimming skills and brought them to the Americas to basically exploit those skills, to make a lot of money, to use them as pearl divers, as salvage divers, to harvest shellfish like conch, to harvest sponge. So they had a really, again, rich tradition that they brought to the Americas and that enslavers exploited and that they also used during their free time, you know, to cool off after working for 12, 14 hours a day and as forms of recreation. So they had, again, I mean, really rich traditions.
And that's just one example of a skill that enslaved Africans transported to the Americas, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they brought all sorts of skills to the Americas. I mean, one thing that I think is really interesting is that if we think of the wealthiest colony and state in America, most Americans, at least most of my students, would assume it would be a northern state, you know, New York or Rhode Island or something like that. But it's actually South Carolina. And what made South Carolina so wealthy was that enslaved Africans brought rice growing traditions to South Carolina. They began growing rice in their free time, and rice in the 1600s, 1700s was actually a really expensive luxury for Europeans. And so their enslavers ended up then exploiting that, these African rice growing traditions, to make a lot of money and then to transform, again, South Carolina into the wealthiest colony and state in America up to the Civil War.
That's so interesting. I had no idea. I want to get back to your research around water. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm African American. I grew up with this idea that swimming was just not part of our culture. Where did I get that idea? Where did that idea come from?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm African American too, and I'm keenly aware of that that myth. So what ends up happening is that enslaved Africans in America, they maintained their traditions up to the end of slavery, and then freed people actually maintained these traditions up into the early 20th century. But what began to happen in the late 1800s is that waterways, natural waterways, began to become desirable places for white Americans. So ocean beaches, and then as well as beaches on lakes and rivers. And as white Americans saw these as kind of desirable recreational places, they began to force African Americans off of these waterways. They began to segregate them, force them into less desirable places. And beaches end up becoming racially contested spaces. And so an example of that would be like the Chicago race riot of 1919, when this black swimmer, Eugene Williams, accidentally floated into a white, from a black beach into a white beach, and was pelted to death with stones and bricks. And then black communities were attacked. And then you also had the rise of, I mean, with the development of pools became racially segregated. And so black people had less and less opportunity to really swim. And so by the 1940s or so, you had seen a really steep decline in the African-Americans' ability to swim. And so what ends up happening then is that in the 1960s, as African-Americans were taking more and more interest in their history, they began to seek out kind of explanations for why they were poor swimmers. And so you have the development then of a number of myths. I mean, one of the myths is that the slave trade was so traumatic that it actually created some kind of a psychological scar that discouraged generations of African Americans from swimming. Another one was that slave owners, in order to prevent captives from running away to the American North, actually discouraged them from swimming, which would have prevented them from swimming across waterways like the Ohio River or the Potomac. And then another myth within the African American community is that water was used as a form of torture, so that they'd be used simulated drownings and things as a form of punishment. And then again, that this created some sort of a psychological scar that deterred generations of people from swimming. And none of these are actually true.
And then I suppose the idea was also perpetuated by the media and by statements made by notable public figures.
Yeah, so you have two sets of myths. And you have myths that were created by African Americans, and then you also have myths that were created by white Americans. And so white Americans, I mean, what began to happen was that the black drowning death rate became much higher than the white drowning death rate. I mean, today, African Americans are all the studies are regional, but they're 6 to 10 times more likely to drown than white Americans. And so in the 1950s, 1960s, white Americans began looking for explanations as to why this black drowning death rate was so much higher, or why, say, when African Americans were joining the Army or the Navy, they couldn't swim. And so there were these pseudoscientific explanations that allowed white Americans to really kind of sidestep the realities that it was racism, that there weren't swimming pools in African-American communities, that black people weren't allowed to go to beaches. You know, if they lived in the Northeast or along the Great Lakes, that they weren't allowed to go to a lot of beaches. And so there were these claims that black people's bones were too dense, that they lacked buoyancy, or that somehow they were just racially, they could not swim, that they naturally could not swim as a result of their race.
So why was it important for you to do the work that you're doing to unpack this myth?
Yeah, so for me, it was really, and I grew up in Southern California, swimming and surfing, and I became aware of these myths at a really early age. And it wasn't so much that I was trying to unpack the myth or to counter the myth. It was that I was really able to study. I mean, as I got into college, I was able to study topics that were close to me. I ended up finding accounts of Africans and enslaved people swimming and surfing. And it was really striking to me since, again, I mean, there's these myths that African Americans don't swim. And so that drew me into really looking at kind of the historical legacies of the slave trade. And then, I mean, understanding how enslaved people in America could recreate all of these swimming traditions, and then how, after slavery, American racism ends up really denying African Americans of this African cultural heritage.
And what would it look like to you to reclaim that heritage?
That's a really good question. I mean, one of the things I think that's interesting, like if we look back at historical sources, during the early modern period, so basically from 1500 into the 1800s, most people of European descent couldn't swim for a whole host of reasons. One is that they felt that just immersing human bodies into water would cause diseases, that was the cause of cholera, of dysentery, of the bubonic plague. And then also there were these beliefs that, or I should say the Catholic Church, discouraged swimming for moral reasons. This is in Europe, but because most people swam nude, church officials discouraged swimming. And so what ends up happening then is that when there's maritime disasters, it becomes predictable as far as who's going to swim and who's going to drown, with white people typically drowning unless they're saved by a person of African or American Indian descent, and people of African descent and American Indian descent being able to swim to save themselves. And so under slavery, actually what happens is that a lot of slave owners, they actually employed slaves as lifeguards. So if they went on a family outing that was along a waterway, they would oftentimes bring along a couple of enslaved people who would, again, serve as lifeguards to watch their children to make sure their children didn't drown. And so you end up then having this, again, this African-Americans engaging in all of these sorts of their skills being exploited. But also, I think what's really striking, and I mean, because you said, what would it look like? So I guess maybe to back up a little bit, I mean, enslaved Africans, they end up recreating, again, their African traditions in America. And I would suspect that we would see African-Americans still engaging in these traditions at a pretty large scale. And so what I mean by that is that slaves during their free time, you know, they're swimming. They would oftentimes swim to cool off, to relax their muscles after working for their owners all day. They would engage in swimming races and competitions. So sometimes slave owners would actually clip the wings of a duck and put it in a pond and give a prize to the slave who could catch that duck. Slaves also engaged in aquatic blood sport. So African men would dive into waterways to fight crocodiles and sharks with knives. And in the Americas, enslaved men did the same thing. There's also accounts of slaves. The earliest account of a slave I found surfing is in the early 1800s, although I suspect they were surfing before then. So we would probably have seen African-Americans swimming, surfing rather, throughout, well, African-Americans surfing, as well as people of African descent surfing in the Caribbean. And so, you know, these traditions are kind of wiped away by really the rise of I think, racial violence after slavery is abolished.
Well, this has been such an eye-opening conversation. I thank you so much for taking the time to share your research with us.
Yeah, not a problem. I appreciate it.